We're a few weeks into 2020, which means that the tax forms are starting to arrive. Luigi, do you have a sense of what your total tax rate was last year?
Actually, to be honest, I went and looked. I knew that you will ask this question. Actually, some things are easy to determine. If you divide the taxes you pay, federal and state, by my total income, I got a 27.7%.
Okay, that's pretty high.
But then local sale taxes, property taxes, and then imputed corporate taxes, that's hard.
But I mean, like, if you had to ballpark it, what do you think your number would be?
I tried to ballpark it, and I arrive at 31%.
Yeah, I tried to do the same thing. I think my tax rate was maybe around 30%.
So as you can see, the question of how much taxes people pay is not that easy to determine. We economists spend a lot of time making these calculations and trying to get these estimates right.
So in a recent book by two authors, Saez and Zuckman, they came up with a very interesting and provocative estimate of total tax rates paid by various income brackets or tax brackets. And what they found was that the overall tax rate on the richest 400 households in 2018 was only 23%, which, by the way, seems pretty low, especially if you consider, you know, the tax rates that we just estimated for ourselves and the fact that a comparable tax rate for households making maybe around $100,000 is more like 30%. And so this whole issue has created a mini uproar within the economics profession.
And not just in the economic profession, but I think in the public at large. And some of the results of this study has been published in the New York Times and has received an enormous amount of attention. And so in today's episode, we're going to try to go into the weeds of what we economists use to measure tax rates. And hopefully by the end of the episode, you will be able to judge for yourself whether billionaires in the United States pay lower taxes than everyone else, and whether they should pay more taxes.
From Georgetown University, this is Kate Waldock.
And from the University of Chicago, this is Luigi Zingales.
You're listening to Capitalism, a podcast about what's working in capitalism today.
And most importantly, what isn't.
Who better to discuss the triumph of injustice with than one of the authors, Emmanuel Saez, who is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley, a director of the Center of Equitable Growth at UC Berkeley, is a John Bates Clark Medal recipient, and a former MacArthur Fellowship awardee. Welcome to the show, Emmanuel.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here with the two of you.
So in your book, there are a lot of very interesting claims and claims that have generated an enormous amount of research. You're the most attack economist of recent times. Let's start with one, which is the progressivity of the U.S. taxation system. Can you explain to us how do you come up with the claim that basically the total tax rate that people pay is fairly flat, whether you make $10,000 a year or you are Warren Buffett, is roughly the same number?
Yes. So people have the sense that the tax system is progressive because they focus mostly on the most visible tax, which is the individual income tax that has progression with higher tax rates, you know, the higher your income. But in reality, this is only part of the tax system. And so what we do in the book is to really distribute all taxes, not only the individual income tax, but also payroll taxes and taxes at the state and local level, sales taxes, property taxes, excise taxes, etc. And so what you find when you pile up all the taxes, tax rates are low starting at the bottom. You know, the payroll tax is 15% and it starts on the first dollar. So you make a minimum wage and you are going to pay 15% in taxes. Now, you make a minimum wage, you don't save much. You have to consume all your income, and you are going to have to pay significant sales taxes and excise taxes. And that's how, you know, you quickly get in the low 20s at the bottom.
Okay, so we have 25% at the bottom end. What about at the top end?
Yes. So average, economy-wide, it's 28%. Those are the macro numbers. So at the bottom, it's slightly below. It increases throughout, you know, the working class, the middle class, the upper middle class, people like us. And what we found is that at the very top, it comes down. But it comes down only really for a very small group at the top, but that's a very, very important group, you know, a group that we've dubbed the top 400, the billionaires, as described, you know, by the Forbes list. So it's very important to understand why is it that their tax rate, as we estimated, is lower. It falls down to 23%. Take the case of Jeff Bezos, the richest man in America. His income is his share of profits from Amazon, and that's in the billions of dollars every year. What are the taxes he pays on that income? Well, he's going to pay some corporate tax, but the corporate tax has come down quite a bit with the Trump tax cut, and those big multinationals are also pretty good at lowering their tax rate. Actually, there were articles that the Amazon corporate tax bill was close to zero last year. Now, he's not going to pay individual income tax if he doesn't distribute himself some income in the form of dividends or selling his shares. And Amazon doesn't distribute dividends. So if he's a frugal person, doesn't need the income to consume, his individual income tax is basically zero relative to his true income. And so at the top among billionaires, we've estimated that some people distribute themselves very little, so their individual income tax rate is almost zero. Others use their income more, so they pay more significant taxes. But on average, that's why it's actually lower than for the upper middle class, people like us, where all our economic income is going to flow through the individual tax return.
So if I had to summarize the way that Emmanuel and Gabriel, his co-author, allocate taxes, it would be that the most intuitive way seems to just add up whatever, let's say, federal income taxes people have paid and divide that by how much money they made last year. But that's not what they do. They actually look at the total amount of taxes that are paid by everything in the economy, not just human beings, but also corporations. And they say, look, corporations, even nonprofits, those are ultimately taxes that are borne by people. So let's try and figure out a way to allocate those taxes to individuals. How are we going to do that? Well, who owns corporations? The shareholders. Those shareholders are disproportionately really, really wealthy people. And so let's allocate the percentage of taxes that are paid by corporations to the really wealthy. And, you know, to some extent to the rest of the society through pensions and through savings. But most of that tax rate will belong to the richest people. Whereas for everyone else, most of the money that we make is through our income, not necessarily through our capital gains or our stock holdings. And so the percentage taxes that everyone else pays, those are mostly made up of federal and state taxes, as well as sales taxes, which, by the way, if you think about it percentage-wise, fall disproportionately on the lower end of the income distribution. So then finally, they add all this up. They take averages across states, across cities, and then they say, look, for each decile of the income distribution, what is the roughly average tax rate that's being paid across all of those people? And that's how they construct their ultimate figures.
But I will make a distinction between sort of that statutory tax rate and what people actually end up paying because of elusion, evasion, and so on and so forth. So let's take your assumption. Jeff Bezos has a gigantic amount of wealth into Amazon. Amazon doesn't pay dividends. But until 2 years ago, was paying 35% or should have paid 35% on the profits at a corporate level. Now it's 21. And the moment it sells, because even if he's frugal, I don't think he makes a lot of money in his income. And he likes to buy expensive apartments in New York and et cetera. So eventually, he's going to sell his stuff, and he pays a 20% on his realization of capital gains. So in an ideal world, with a current statutory tax rate, if there is no illusion, you get 21 plus 20. Now, it's not cumulative, but it amounts to roughly 36. So we wouldn't be that bad if in a world in which there are not a lot of loopholes.
Except that if you are a billionaire, you don't need to realize your income. A lot of those multi-billionaires are going to go through their lives without realizing their full income. The most striking example is perhaps Warren Buffett, who's claimed, you know, that he really wants to accumulate within his company, Berkshire Hathaway, and lives very frugally.
Yeah, but honestly, Warren Buffett is the wrong example because he decided to donate most of his income to charity. So he will never realize it. And why should he pay taxes if he never realized it? And two, I agree with you that there is a major loophole, which is, and this is a technical term, but it's a step up of the basis at inheritance. So if Warren Buffett keeps all his stock until his death, and then he passes to his children don't have to pay capital gain tax rate. So if we were just to plug that loophole, which I think is a pretty outrageous loophole, we would be in a world that is much more fair to begin with.
So I agree with you that that's an obvious loophole and an urgent one to plug. And indeed, a number of candidates are proposing, you know, it's been long proposed on the Democratic side.
So what would you propose for the top end?
Yeah. So what we think is that at the very high end, what works best to increase or restore progressivity is the wealth tax based on individual wealth. Okay, and that's a proposal that has gotten a lot of attention in the policy debate. It's been proposed by Senator Warren, Senator Sanders. And for the very top, it is the most effective because, as we discussed earlier, Jeff Bezos may not realize that much income, but it's very easy to see how much wealth he has. So if you impose an annual wealth tax, you know, 1, 2, 3% or more on his wealth, you're really going to tax him in a very significant way. And indeed, we've done some of the calculation, add a wealth tax to our chart, and you very quickly increase sharply tax rates at the very top.
I'm not ideologically opposed to wealth tax. We debated with Kate, but I'm a little bit puzzled because you are proposing in the book a wealth tax and a maximum marginal tax rate of 75%.
So here we have to be careful. The wealth tax would count as part of the overall tax on income. So what we are proposing, if you wanted, you know, to increase the tax rate, the average tax rate at the top to about 60%, which corresponds, roughly speaking, to a 75% marginal tax rate, you could do it through a combination, you know, of a better working corporate tax, a wealth tax, and perhaps fixing some of the things, you know, on the individual income tax. But the concept of marginal tax doesn't work that well anymore, you know, if you think about the wealth tax, because the wealth tax goes after your stock. If you make more money, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to pay more in taxes.
But so what do you, if you had your way and you introduce a wealth tax, what would you put the marginal tax rate on income?
On income, you don't need, maybe, you know, you don't necessarily need to go above 50%, because at the very high end, the individual income tax doesn't do a great job at capturing income. So that's why you need the wealth tax. And now for the upper middle class or people like us, how much you want to tax us is debatable. If you want to increase our taxes quite a bit, then yes, you use the individual income tax. But if you really want to hit the billionaires or even, you know, the Santai millionaires, the wealth tax is the tool you want to use.
I actually disagree on this point. The most effective way to equalize or make the country more equal is trying to eliminate the rents that some people enjoy. So my favorite example is Carlos Slim, used to be the richest man on earth. He lost half of his wealth. Now, don't cry for him because he's still worth $30 billion. So he's not exactly poor by any standard. But he lost half of his wealth almost overnight. Why? Because Mexico opened up the market for telecommunication, both in mobile and in fixed line. And his major source of wealth was a mobile and fixed operator in Mexico. And so that created competition. That creation of competition not only reduced his wealth, but gave cheaper phone lines to every Mexican. So is a very nice redistribution and done, I would say, the market way rather than the brutal taxation way.
I mean, if you look historically, when you want to go after an oligarchic problem, that is the wealthy having too much power, you have to throw a lot of policy tools at them. And generally, those tools go together. That is, when you are going to go aggressively antitrust, you know, curbing down the power of monopolies, you also use, you know, more progressive taxation, at least in history. The countries, you know, that have successfully reduced income and wealth concentration have tended to use those tools together rather than substitutes. And I think you see that also in the political campaign, that is, the candidates who really want to tax the rich more are also those who want to be very aggressively, you know, pushing antitrust.
I don't dispute that historically, even now, there is a correlation between the use of the instrument. But from an economic point of view, they could be substitutes. So it's interesting that they are not being used as substitute. But I have to say, and maybe this is my reading, I have to say that reading your book, I got the impression that yes, you want more equality for political reasons, for this or that. But at the end of the day, there is almost like a moral sense that you don't want billionaires, that you want to eliminate them one way or another. That is not just an economic distortion, is almost like a moral distortion. Am I reading too much between the lines?
That's not wrong. But what I would say is that, yes, the market creates very successful businesses and therefore creates billionaires, you know, if you found a thing. And I don't think we need billionaires to dominate, you know, a market for as long. And therefore, I'm not against billionaires, but they shouldn't stay billionaires for as long. And it's something you can achieve through taxation, but also through, you know, more competition, as you were offering. I think an economy where people at the very top churn more, you don't stay, you know, that rich for as long, is an economy that would indeed work better.
Yeah, I mean, these are issues that come up a lot on this podcast. Maybe I'm just being too diplomatic, but I agree with both of you. But even if we had like perfectly functioning antitrust laws in the United States today, just because of the nature of globalization, of automation, of, you know, multinationals, like agglomeration effects and network externalities, like we will ultimately invariably have people who are billionaires because big companies tend to be the ones that prevail in society today. And, you know, maybe $1 billion is fine, but if you amass $50 billion of wealth, chances are that not only will you have an undue influence on the political system during your lifetime, but your children will as well, and your children's children will as well, and their children will also be billionaires. And I think Emmanuel is right. That is problematic from an inequality point of view, and it's problematic when it comes to how we run our government.
I agree with the concern on the government, but there is nothing magic about a billion, okay? I understand a billion is a lot of money, but 100 million is a lot of money too. Even 10 million for most people is a lot of money. So what is the right amount? I'm a little bit nervous of going in the direction of saying we don't want billionaires because tomorrow is going to be we don't want, I don't know what is the term,
Centimillionaires.
Centimillionaires.
Well, then Bernie Sanders is your man because he's offering, you see, a graduated wealth tax, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8%, all the way to 10 billion. I agree that it's not a magic number, but what you feel is that the higher you go, the more you need the tool, you know, the winds, the headwinds, you know, through the policy tools. And then that has to be graduated.
But one issue we did not discuss is what are these taxation systems, what are the effects that might have in attracting people and especially entrepreneurs, especially innovators in the United States? What do you say about that?
I say that we don't know. So there's a lot of statements one can make. But my feel, looking at how humans behave, is that what's most important for innovation is to help you when you're starting, you know, giving you a good education, the opportunity to come to this country and deploy your ideas. The wealth tax hits you only after you've succeeded. And therefore, it might be that it's there as something, yes, I'd have to pay that, but I don't think, you know, based on everything we know about how people discount, how people, you know, make decision, that it would be such a big negative impact. In other words, the motivation, you know, to do stuff is not just, you know, the hard cash you will get at the end. And the wealth tax kicks in only if you really succeed, you know, so it doesn't remove, you know, your ability to create a business in the first place.
I totally agree that entrepreneurs are not only motivated by money, but I thought that also soccer players were not only motivated by money. And one of my favorite papers is one you wrote about soccer players in Europe and how they move around very much as a function of the tax rate. And I have to admit, I'm really pissed because Italy did a special tax for foreign players and foreign financial executives that made possible for Juventus to hire Cristiano Ronaldo. And so Cristiano Ronaldo pays only 100,000 euro of taxes for all the foreign income he has. So all the endorsement, everything is taxed as a zero marginal tax rate. But your paper shows that this has an enormous impact. So Spain might be broken financially, but won the World Cup, attracting the best players.
Yes, but you're right. But the big difference there is that in football, you move and you immediately pay the lower tax. Here, it's a very different situation because you start a business and you start without the fortune yet. And there's a lot the US can do to attract more entrepreneurs. You see, for on immigration, for example, we put constraints. The current administration, you know, wants to crack down on immigration of all sorts. You know, so in principle, you know, you could open that, you know, to get more talented people to come to study in our universities and then thrive in the economy. Then once they are wealthy, I agree, you need some design, you know, to make sure they cannot flee, you know, with their money and escape taxation. In the US, that has a citizenship-based taxation where taxes follow you even if you move to another country is actually as a pretty extreme but very effective way of preventing people to move out.
We're both immigrants, so we are both in favor of opening up more of the borders. But even there is a paper, this one not written by you, but one of your co-author, Stancheva, looking at innovators and the fact that they do move where their tax rate is lower. So they don't make a lot of money up front, but they seem to be very rational in locating where tax rates are lower. So I wouldn't be surprised if innovator in the future move to Singapore and not the Silicon Valley.
Okay. I mean, look, this is a legitimate question. I feel like the power, you know, of your educational system, the agglomeration effects that Kate was describing are very powerful. But it's true, you know, if we are in a scenario, we put a wealth tax and Silicon Valley moves to Singapore, that would be a bad outcome. I don't think it's likely, but we should be on the look, you know, for any such effects.
If you like listening to Capital Isn't, there's a good chance you're interested in pioneering research and groundbreaking discoveries. Big Brains, another podcast from the University of Chicago, brings the work and ideas of the world's smartest thinkers straight to your earbuds, with guests like David Axelrod.
If you know people, if you understand something about them, it's harder to dehumanize them, it's harder to hate them, even if you disagree with them.
Richard Thaler.
Those two words, systematic bias, that was the big aha moment. If there are systematic biases, then you can make better predictions.
And Eve Ewing.
We now, in the past couple of decades, have started thinking about schools not as things that we have rights to, but rather something that we are to consume and choose.
You'll hear the stories behind the research reshaping our world. Listen and subscribe to Big Brains wherever you get your podcasts.
There is one thing that I think that has received no criticism, at least as far as I know, and I'm interested in knowing, maybe you know if it did, which is how little taxes multinationals pay. Because I think that this is, in my view, the biggest scandal. I don't think that is necessarily your biggest discovery, but I think that you documented in the book in a very effective way with some examples that really are revolting. One example, and for once, let's not only talk about bad American companies, because this is a Swede and a Dane, so the people that generally pay a lot of taxes, but they transfer the intellectual value of Skype for 25,000 euro shortly before they sold the entire thing for, what, 3 and something billion? So the trick that many multinationals play is to transfer some rights in fiscal paradise like Luxembourg. So you transfer this right there, and then the entity that is in the fiscal paradise charges a fortune, an arm and a leg, for the use of that right to the operating company in the various countries. In this case, Skype was based where? In Sweden? So in Sweden. And so Sweden does not see any or very little profits, but all the profits are accumulated in this remote location. And there is an entire cottage industry of accountants and consultants that are paid very heavily in order to prove the impossible, to prove that the transfer of the Skype right to Luxembourg was really worth only €25,000. So did anybody challenge you on that front?
It's true this one didn't receive nearly as much criticism. I agree it is perhaps the biggest scandal of globalization as it has happened. That is, it's clear that the biggest winners of globalization are those large multinational companies that can deploy their activities worldwide. And we are in a system where they can essentially choose where they report their profits. And obviously, they choose to report their profits through the tax gimmicks. You know, you've described one of them in tax havens, where the tax rates are extremely low. So it's not. I should say, though, that there is movement on the policy front. And if you read the footnotes, almost, you know, of the Democratic candidates' platform, they are going aggressively against, you know, the existing system so that we could tax multinationals better. And indeed, the point of our book is that the fact that the multinationals escape taxes, that's because the system is poorly designed and there is strong lobbying, you know, to protect that system. But technically, nothing would prevent us from taxing multinationals much more effectively.
So if nothing is preventing us, what are some of the key policy proposals that you put forward
Yes.
in your book?
So essentially, we know because we have the data, the government has the data, the US government, for each multinational, how much profits they report in each country and how much they pay in taxes in each of those countries. So it's very easy for the US government can see whether companies like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, etc., are reporting a lot of their profits in tax havens. And if they do, then it wouldn't be complicated to apply a remedial tax. That is, if the US tax is, say, 21%, that's what it is today. If you pay less than 21% on your profits in one country, the US is going to collect what's missing so that it moves up to 21%. And that way, it's very hard to multinationals to avoid paying the taxes, because we can see the global profits, they allocate it in some ways, but if there is missing taxes, the US is going to be the collector.
I actually find this one of the most interesting proposals of your book, and almost like seems to defy gravity, because most people say, oh, but if you tax multinationals, they're going to move abroad. But you say no, because whether they move abroad or don't move abroad, you're going to tax them based on the sales they do in this country. And this is not just an issue in the United States, it's an issue in Europe as well. Every individual country is desperate to raise more revenues. And it seems like this is kind of a bonanza that easily you can tax multinationals. Think about a country like Italy or a country like Germany or a country like France. You can tax Google and Amazon. Why don't you see that in place?
The answer I can offer is that I think because multinationals have a strong, very, very strong interest in keeping the system as it is. So they fight very hard to keep it. They use their lobbying power to make sure, you know, those ideas don't get through. And it's in part, I think, you know, the work that Gabriel Zucman has been doing about showing statistics and also explaining in a very simple way how you could remedy the situation with the data we already have, that I think can have a real impact. I mean, in France, you did see a little bit of a response, you know, with the GAFA tax that singles out the technology firms to tax them a little bit in France for the activity they do. But it's a very small small, imperfect solution when a bigger, more global solution is at hand, if there is, you know, the political will.
Yeah, but this is what is really puzzling to me, because if you're saying that, you know, the U.S. legislators or the U.S. president is captured by Amazon and Facebook, that's kind of understandable. But you're saying that even Macron is in the pocket of the big multinationals.
Yes, or I would say in Europe, you have the strong feeling that Europe, the European constitution, is built on the principle, the ideological principle, that tax competition is good. So it's not like they want to get rid of the system. They somehow have the feeling that it's good to have countries try, you know, to attract more economic activities. And it'd be bad if countries decided, you know, to kill that through a system, you know, where you base the tax based on your global profits.
I agree with that. But what to me was very interesting in your book is saying one thing is tax competition, but you can go around with this remedial system. So the fact that the EU was set up in this way, etc., does not prevent Macron to go after the multinationals individually in France, but he's not willing to do it. So the only explanation is Macron is captured by multinationals.
Yeah, no, but I think Macron has said it explicitly. He loves the idea that there are big winners of globalization. He called them, you know, the premier de cordée, the first, you know, in the rope line. And therefore, I think ideologically, he feels that's a good thing, you know, that those big winners pay few taxes. I really think that's his ideology.
So as I was saying at the beginning, your work has been very controversial, which is a positive thing. It means people pay attention. As economists, the worst thing that can happen to you is that nobody pay attention. You had most papers criticized and sometimes pretty aggressively by other people. I don't think we want to bother the listeners with all these critiques because really we're getting into the deep weed. But I want your assessment. If you had to pick, what is the most fair criticism that was raised through your work?
I mean, I think it's the one we look only at taxes, and taxes are only one half of what governments do. Governments also use those taxes to spend, and that benefits the bottom more, you know, relative to their income than the rich. So we're not saying that the government worsens inequality. We are just saying that on the revenue side, it's not as progressive as it could be. It's not as progressive as it has been. And that's what we want to emphasize in this book.
So we don't often, or at least we try not to often talk about drama on this podcast. But I think in this case, it's somewhat interesting. So you've been experiencing a particularly high dose of drama for the past few months, it seems. What has that been like, and were you surprised by it?
What struck me the most is how well organized the think tank community, particularly on the conservative side. I really saw the power of think tanks in actions, in the sense that they had lots of people able to be very reactive and write very quickly to precisely translate, you know, the academic criticisms into digestible pieces. It is as if, you know, they had been ramping up their staff, their activity, and finally they got something, you know, to fight against, and they were ready suddenly to flood the social media sphere. And, you know, at a higher level, what I take out of that is that, yes, the issue of taxes and how taxes should be set by income group is obviously one of the most fundamental questions in how you run a government. Different groups will have very different views about what is best to do. So it's not surprising that it becomes a fight. And when you are fighting, your objective is to win. And therefore, you care about whether the arguments, you know, are going to resonate rather than, you know, academic truth or anything. So you had a mix where it was no longer possible to really have an objective debate because groups were invested, you know, in how this would be perceived rather than what is the truth, you know, of the matter.
Now, to be the devil's advocate here, though, I think one criticism that economists, academic economists, have launched against the book is that some of the statistics you were showing, they were seeing for the first time in, like, David Leonhardt's piece in the New York Times, rather than having seen these numbers in, like, a peer-reviewed economic study. Do you think that this is a fair criticism?
So our book is based primarily on our academic work. You know, previous peer-reviewed, published work. What is true is that some elements of the books were about refining those methodology, precisely to look at the very top and the top 400 in more detail. Those, you know, were not peer-reviewed, so everything came out exactly at the time of publication of the book. And now the New York Times wanted to do an exclusive. And so they told us, you know, don't divulge, you know, any of your statistics, your Excel sheets in advance of our article. Their article comes a week before. So it's true, there was a gap there, but it had more to do with the nature, you know, of the media. When they agree to do an exclusive specifically on your thing, they want exclusivity. This criticism has been launched at others, colleagues. I remember Rash Chetty, a very prominent economist working on mobility, has been criticized sometimes. Hey, you present and you get the New York Times article before we, the academics, can see the results. And we were caught into that situation as well.
But to be fair, this is a problem of the profession in general. It's not specific to Emmanuel or not specific to other people, because unlike in other sciences where you don't divulge your results until they are published, also because they're published much faster, we divulge our results in a working paper form. And it says all the papers were published in the NBR, they are not peer-reviewed, and they are discussed by the NBR itself, by the press, while not being peer-reviewed. So I can see the argument of moving to a different equilibrium, but accusing Emmanuel of this is like accusing him of the responsibility of the entire profession. It seems a bit unfair in this particular case.
Agreed. So, Emmanuel, at the end of our podcast, we usually ask each other this question. Whatever the topic is that a capital is or a capital isn't? So we've discussed a lot of topics on this podcast, but I think we've spent most of our time on taxes on the wealthy in the United States. So do you think this system is a capital is or a capital isn't?
I mean, to me, it's clear that capitalism needs to be regulated, and therefore taxing the wealthy looks like capitalism. That is, you confiscate wealth, but ultimately it is to have, you know, a more thriving economy so that market economies really can work for everybody, so that we can have a capitalism system we are happy with and is sustainable.
So I will divide and I say the current system of taxation, especially a corporation, is definitely a capital isn't. I disagree with Emmanuel that his proposed plan will be so great for capitalism, but that's a different story. What about you, Kate?
Wait a second, Luigi. I thought that you said in a prior episode, maybe it was a while ago, but that you would be in favor of a small wealth tax.
I said I'm not ideological against a small wealth tax. I'm not so sure that I want to go as far as Emmanuel is suggesting, and also with all the other things he put in together. I think that I'm not trying to equalize outcomes through taxation. I think that's clearly what I disagree with. I do believe in progressivity of income tax, and I do believe that the rich have to pay their fair share, which is more than the share that everybody else pays.
I think it's pretty obvious that if there are loopholes that are only available to the richest handful of people in the United States, then their ability to exploit those loopholes is a capital isn't. Do I think that we need to, you know, eliminate billionaires by taxing them at on the order of 90%? Obviously not, but, you know, we should at least have a system that's slightly progressive in the sense that if you're a billionaire, you're paying more percentage-wise in taxes than someone making $50,000 a year.
You've been listening to Capital Isn't. hosted by Kate Waldock and Luigi Zangalis, and produced by Matt Hodapp. Capital Isn't is a podcast of the University of Chicago Stiegler Center in collaboration with the Chicago Booth Review. You can find episode transcripts and research links at capitalism.com. Also, check out promarket.org, the blog of the Stiegler Center, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.